So tonight, for a few minutes, I want to ask the question and kind of pursue this. Do we trust Jesus? Which I know we're like, yeah, we trust Jesus. We're here. We're doing this, so we trust Jesus. But really, I guess the question is, do we really trust him? Let's look over in Matthew 14, one of my favorite passages, I think, in the life of Jesus as he does something that no one would ever think about doing, and that is walking on water. It's a very familiar story. I know since I've been here, I've probably mentioned this once every other month or so. It's just a great story. Peter, of course, comes shining out because he himself wants to join Jesus out on the water. We'll talk for a few minutes about this question in regard to Peter, because that's really what it is. Do we trust Jesus? We could talk all day about it, but the bottom line is Peter trusted Jesus. Command me also to walk on water, and he does, and he does. And the rest of the apostles probably thought Peter was an idiot, especially at this moment, simply because he wanted to do something like this. But this is right after the feeding of the 5,000, and I don't know that they're putting all this together. It doesn't seem that they are, because in the next couple of chapters there are certain things that happen that Jesus actually rebukes them that they don't have the faith that they should. And these are people who stayed with Jesus. They spent time with Jesus. They would be able to hear him pray for them. It's not apostles who had no time with Jesus. They had a lot of time with Jesus over the course of about 3 years. Now, as he feeds the 5,000, it closes with, in verse 20, 21, that they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces left over. And these baskets would be large baskets. 12 is for the apostles. So each one of them had a very large basket. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So all kinds of estimations come up, 10,000 people maybe. It could be 15,000, it could be even more. We just don't know. 5,000 men. And so in verse 22, we read that immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. This is in the scene of what's called Lake Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee, same body of water. It's very small, but it's in an area where there are high winds and storms come up pretty quick. Well, after he dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, so we're talking about as dark as it's going to get. And to me, it's almost kind of funny, actually. In the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Now, Mark actually tells us that he wanted to walk away from them. In other words, he saw them and he didn't want to go right to them. He wanted to go around them. Which when Mark does that, it's like, why would Jesus do that? Why doesn't Jesus like walk straight to them? But Matthew doesn't really put that in there. Mark does. Matthew doesn't. Matthew makes it sound like he came to them. And as he did so, walking on the sea, the disciples saw him walking on the sea. That's mentioned twice. Verse 25, walking on the sea. Verse 26, walking on the sea. They were, and I would add the word appropriately, terrified. You know, this is not a thing. If you've ever been out on the water at night, it's dark, especially if it's moonless. We're not told if the moon was out or not. But if it's moonless, it's even darker than you might expect. But the bottom line is it's dark. The water's dark. The sky's dark. And then you see somebody walking on the sea. You don't poke somebody and go, oh, you remember George last week? He was walking on the sea. We saw that. This just doesn't happen. And so they are terrified, and that's a good word to use here. And they screamed, really, it is a ghost, and they cried out in fear. Now, we know when someone cries out like they're surprised, it sounds like something. If it's a painful cry, it sounds like, you know, pain. A bunch of men, grown men, by the way, are scared. They're scared, and they're screaming. You can imagine, this is a little comical. These grown men screaming, thinking it's a ghost coming at them in the water. And immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take heart, it is I. Don't be afraid. Peter answered, Lord, if it's you, which kind of shows a little bit of doubt in Peter's mind. It's a ghost. They're terrified. If it's you, then command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. And so Peter got out of the boat. I don't know what kind of boat you think of. I almost always, as a kid, when we would hear this story, I think of a canoe. You know, low to the water, you just step out and you're on the water. More than likely, the boat they would use would be like from the waterline up to the top of the boat, maybe 10 or even 15 feet. A lot of the fishing boats they used were shaped in a very peculiar way, and they were actually pretty good sized boats. So, if you think about that, as a possibility, Peter doesn't just walk out of the boat, he had to climb down. So, in climbing down, it makes it a little bit more of an effort to get down out of the boat, but then also walking on the water, because again, we are already told that the wind is against them. So this isn't a calm moment. This is a boisterous moment. The water is probably beating up against the hull. They're having to bob up and down. He's doing all this just to get to the water, to walk on the water. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. Same word about them being terrified, by the way. And beginning to sink, he then cried out, "Lord, save me." Again, this is a fearful cry, but he doesn't sink. It's not normal where you step in the water and just go because there's nothing holding you. He begins to sink. And again, just a miraculous sort of mind-blowing thing going on here. And Jesus rebukes all of them, "O ye of little faith." Now, newer English translations, I know this morning in our Bible class we were talking about the old King James. That's one of the greatest benefits of the King James, the American Standard Revised Version. The archaic language makes it clear in English whether you're having a plural or a singular. "O you of little faith" would be you, Peter. "O ye" means all of you. You know, if I was translating today, I would say "ye" would be the modern day y'all. You know, y'all of little faith. That's really what it is. And so he rebukes them all. "Why did you doubt?" And when they, Peter and Jesus, got into the boat, the wind ceased. Can you imagine that? The wind just stopped. And those in the boat, this is what I referenced this morning, they worshiped him. And they said, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, Peter shows trust. I mean, he does. He says, "If it's you," I mean, he hears it's Jesus. He says, "If it's you, command me." And Jesus says, "Come," and he goes. So at least out of these men, we do find Peter. And he's a natural-born leader. I would say that because we have a few instances where he goes to do something, everybody goes with him. Probably the easiest is John 21 when he tells the apostles, "I'm going fishing." This is after Jesus' death, burial, resurrection. And in that 50-day period of Jesus being out and about and not spending all his time with the apostles, surprisingly, Peter says, "I'm going fishing," and the rest of them say, "We're going with you." Peter's that kind of magnetic personality. He's the guy who says, "I'm doing something." People are like, "We're joining you." I'm the sort of guy, honestly, and it's just the way it is. I go, "I'm going." People go, "All right, we'll see you." You know, Peter had the sort of personality that people wanted to be with him. And so it's surprising to me nobody else joined Peter and Jesus, but no surprise, honestly, that Peter would be the one, "Command me to get out." This is, you know, you think back when Jesus rises from the dead and Mary announces he's not dead, that Peter and John go running out of the room right to the tomb. John beats Peter. If you ever have a Trivial Pursuit, who was faster? John was faster than Peter, but Peter does Peter things and he just goes right into the tomb. John, we're told, peers into it, and you can almost imagine Peter just pushing John out of the way, just going right on in. It's just the way he is. So, do we really trust Jesus? Would we be getting out of the boat? I wouldn't. I mean, I'm just telling you. I don't like, I mean, there are things I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of not having electricity, I guess, you know. Think about hurricanes. There's brewing storms out, you know, between us and Africa now. And I was texting somebody this afternoon that, you know, it looks like September might be busy, you don't know. And they're like, "Yeah, I just don't want to lose power." That's it. I don't like spiders. Y'all all know that. Somebody put on my Facebook page of a friendly spider. I'm like, there is no such thing at all. But they had this whole thing of a spider that was like a pet. I'm like, this is horrible. This is what nightmares are made of. Well, being out in the deep, dark ocean, that's kind of scary too. I would not be jumping out of the boat. I would be staying in. But this is the point that I want to make. If we really trust Jesus, then we're going to live the way we know we should in trusting Jesus. Jeremiah 17 is a great passage. Go all the way back to Jeremiah 17, 5 to 8. where Jeremiah, it's actually God speaking through Jeremiah, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. It's not like we're living in a time that's new with this. We're going to talk here in a minute about science, because everybody's told to trust the science, as if science contradicts theology, as if science contradicts God. Theories do, but science doesn't actually do that. But do we trust God or we trust men more? He's like a shrub in the desert, the one who trusts in man. He shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places in the wilderness, in an uninhabited salt land. Blessed is the man, this is verse 7, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. He's like a tree planted by water that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes, for its leaves remain green, and is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. And we're not just talking about a season of drought. He says a year of drought. Again, it doesn't stop bearing fruit. This is a great passage. It's in the middle of this section where Jeremiah is trying to tell Israel, or Judah specifically, that they need not trust these idols and trust the people who are telling them, trust the idol. Trust the God who actually exists. That's what he's trying to tell them. And so in our day and time, it might be the phrase according to science, but in other times it's been the sort of thing we trust in our generals. We trust, like in the Old Testament, when they were trusting in chariots. They weren't trusting in God to fight their battles. They were trusting in the fact that they had a lot of chariots, you know? Josiah, that's one of his problems, is he went out to war. He was told by God not to, and he does anyway. Why? He trusted his chariots. He didn't trust God. So we might say today, according to science, and not to deviate too much on all these things, but I think a lot that's offered as science is according to scientists, who are people offering opinions based on theories that aren't provable. It's, you know, in feeds. Google has a thing where you kind of look at news feeds. I sometimes go through it to see what it is. Like everything else, there are algorithms, so it's geared to me. I get a lot about coffee and motorcycles. And it was one day I'm like, why all this about coffee and motorcycles? Because I like coffee and motorcycles. So, you know, again, it's an algorithm. It's geared to me. And every once in a while, there's this article that just pops up. According to science, this is the best shoe to wear. Why do I need to know according to science about shoes? I don't care. The one I had yesterday was, according to science, this is the type of coffee you should be drinking. And I'm like, I'm drinking the coffee I want to be drinking. Science doesn't need to tell me that, you know. But it's just, it's interesting, in my own view, I keep seeing according to science. As if science is some isolated thing that has nothing to do with anything. And these people know all these things. Like, they have manuals. I mean, I know they come up with things, but sometimes that's all it is. I know I've been saying this a little bit more lately. It's something, obviously, it's been on my mind. Science does not contradict the Bible. And the Bible does not contradict science. Now, I know a lot of us probably don't even agree with that statement. We say, no, science does contradict the Bible. Does it? It doesn't. Theories do. Theory of evolution is not a scientific proof. There's no fact. Nobody was there, and I have this, the idea of evolution, the Big Bang Theory. We had a friend that had all kinds of bumper stickers in the back end of his truck, and one of them was, I believe in the Big Bang. God spoke, and bang, it happened. You know, I like that one. You know, God said, let there be light. There was light. The thing is, none of us was there in the beginning. None of us. You know, the earth that we live on has a lot of crazy clues. I say crazy because there are things that are hard to explain. There are things in the strata that you're like, maybe this is proof of a flood. And a lot of scientists do struggle with that because it does seem globally there is proof in the strata, you go deep enough, that there was a cataclysmic thing that happened that disturbed everything everywhere. Well, in the Bible, I would say it's probably the flood. I don't know. I wasn't there to say anything about that one way or the other. But the bottom line is, none of us was there in the beginning. So a scientist may say, I see things and I think this. Okay? That doesn't mean it's so just because a guy has a white coat on, you know? That doesn't make it effect. And I know we know this. The Bible teaches us in Hebrews 11:3 that it is by faith that we understand that the universe was created. And he tells us it was created by the Word of God so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. I put it in a different way here. What is seen was made out of things that are invisible. It's the same statement, but that's the point. The world that we live in is solid. We look at things, we see things, we can touch things, we can smell. But it's made out of the invisible, the atoms, you know. And there are theories. I looked it up because I was just curious. When did the theory of atomic, not energy, but just atomic things, the Greeks had the idea very early on. One or two centuries before Christ came to the earth, there were different Greek philosophers who said, it seems to me that things are made out of invisible things. They had all kinds of ideas that weren't really all that accurate, but more accurate than, you know, you might suppose. But as far as like scientists who say this is what we've actually seen, it was in the late 19th century that they started coming up with very clear ideas that there are smaller pieces to these big pieces of rock that don't seem to ever move. And they're always moving. It's atoms and neutrons and neurons and things that are way beyond my comprehension. And so we won't talk about that. My ignorance shows pretty quick. Earlier in Hebrews 1, verse 2, the writer says, in these last days, God has spoken to us by a Son, whom he appointed to be the heir of everything, and through whom he also made the universe. It's not just the idea that he made the earth. It's the universe that he made. And the word that would be used there, we might say cosmos. That's the Greek word, but that's what they, everything that actually exists. The Bible teaches us, not that God put it into motion for evolution to take over, but he created the universe by his word. And we go back to Genesis chapter 1. There are questions. There's no way to say there are no questions, but God is hovering over the face of the water. Where'd the water come from? We don't know. We're not told the water came as God spoke it into existence. We're just told that the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the water. And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And then God spoke the next thing into existence. And it happened. One of the points I want to make is the earth that we live on does show age. I mean, it shows long age. But think about it. In John chapter 2, let's turn over to John 2 just for the moment. I don't have this on PowerPoint, but John chapter 2, Jesus' first miracle ever. And the miracle is turning water into wine. And that is miraculous. I mean, there's no way to say, well, anybody can do that. Nobody can do that. It was, as we're told in John 2, 1, we're going to read through verse 12 here, that on the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples, and the wine ran out. And the mother of Jesus said, they've no wine. I love this. Jesus, I mean, she just comes up to him. They're out of wine. It's not his wedding. It's not his responsibility. He doesn't run that house. But he gets what she's saying to him, and he says, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. It's not time for me to do anything. His mother said to the servants, do what he tells you. Which meant he's going to do this. He's going to fix it. It's always the dynamic of mothers with their sons, I guess. Now, there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, which means they needed at least that much water to do this. And so Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. They filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some of it out and take it to the master of the feast, the guy who's actually in charge, which I think is pretty interesting. Jesus says to do that. And so they took it, and when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, the poor wine. Because by then, they don't care what they're drinking, they're just drinking it. Doesn't taste good, they don't care. They're at a point, they don't care. You have kept the good wine till now. In other words, this guy was able to tell, this is good wine. This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. I mean, they were impressed by this. And after this, he went down to Capernaum. That's where he spends a lot of time in the first couple years of his ministry. with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stay there for a few days. But wine takes a while to become wine. I don't know much about wine. All I know is that it naturally ferments to a certain percentage. I think it's 11%. After that, if it is bigger than that, higher a number, it's alcohol that's been added. It ferments to a point. But it takes time. It doesn't take an hour or two. It takes months, years to really get to a point. And I know there are people who know a whole lot about wine who say, you know, you find a bottle that's from 18-something, and it might be wine that's really good, and it might be vinegar because of how things happen in that bottle. But what I'm trying to say is this. Jesus, in performing this, performed a miracle in which age had to take place, and he did so immediately. Wine takes time. Not in a miracle. In a miracle, he made it happen immediately, but it was a thing that had to take time. I guarantee you, if the master who, master of the feast, was like, how old is this wine? Oh, it's at least 5 years, 6 years, 10 years. However, his taste buds would determine. But it just happened. And the servants knew that. Can God not create an old earth? Brand new? Yeah, that's my point. I think God can create an earth that may prove itself by the things we test to be very old when it's not very old. Jesus did this miracle in John 2. I think he could do something like that when he spoke everything into existence. Science does not contradict the Bible. It either agrees with it or it doesn't address it. And very often that's what it is. It just doesn't address it. We need to understand that. God is much more powerful. So, thinking along in the same line, do we really trust Jesus? Do we trust people or God? That's what Jeremiah was getting at. If you trust man, you're like a shrub out in the middle of the desert. You're parched. If you trust God, you're like a tree that's going to have no worry at all. Let's look over in 1 Corinthians 1. We're going to start in verse 18 and read through 2:5. It looks really long. It's not that long. 1 Corinthians 1:18, where Paul is dealing with the problem there in Corinth of the division in that church. They divided themselves after Apollos and Paul and Cephas and Christ. And Paul wants to know, did he get killed for them? Well, no, of course not. Are they being baptized in his name? No. So in verse 18, he speaks about the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God, because it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where's the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the debater of the age? Notice, has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Some really smart people sometimes just don't get things. And he's going to make that point as we're going through this section here. Notice, he says, since, in verse 21, since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, Sophia, which is the Greek word. It pleased God through the foolishness or the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. The reason he says they did not know God through wisdom doesn't mean they don't have wisdom. I think the New American Standard might have it a little bit better, where it did not know God through its wisdom. That is, through its pursuit of wisdom. The Greeks elevated wisdom. Any person who was named Sophia, it's like today when people are named Jesus. You know, there is a respect given to the name. Well, Sophia to them was wisdom. That's why you named your daughter Sophia, and you named your young men Sophos, because you wanted them to be wise. And Paul is saying that's not actual wisdom, and through the wisdom of the world, they don't come close to God. It pleased God through, again, the foolishness of what is being preached to save those who believe. 22. Jews are demanding signs, and Greeks are seeking wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block, and to Gentiles, it's foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Might have to read that again. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Now, Paul's not on purpose just saying, y'all a bunch of dummies. But he's saying, look around. Look at yourselves. You're not, according to worldly standards, the smartest people. Not many powerful, not many noble. But God has chosen what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. Almost always when I read this passage, I think of Naaman. Remember, he was captain of the Syrian army, and he had leprosy in 2 Kings 5. And he's in Israel. And the king says, look, go find the prophet. Okay, that's great, but nobody pays attention. And then that little servant girl says, well, there's a prophet back home where I live, and he'll take care of all this. That's when the king freaks out, because he's like, you're trying to start a war, you know, I can't deliver. But Elijah actually does tell him what? Go into the Jordan River, dip seven times. And he's like, the Jordan, it's a dirty river. I want to go home. Pharpar is a better river than the Jordan. And we know the story. He does exactly what he was told to do, because this servant basically was like, look, if he told you to do some great thing, you would have done it. So why not just do this? And he does. And his skin becomes like a baby's. That's the wisdom of the world compared to the foolishness of God, if you will. So again, verse 27 here, God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God has chosen what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are. Why? We're told. Verse 29, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. I know there's a lot of hubris, there's a lot of arrogance. People are like, I'm not going to bow to God. There is no God and all that. They're going to be really wrong. And they're going to be wrong for eternity. No human being is going to boast in God's presence. And because of Him, you're in Christ, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness, sanctification, redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And then notice chapter 2, 1 through 5. When I came to you, I did not come, Paul says, proclaiming testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. I decided to know nothing among you except Christ and Him crucified, which is the foolishness of God, right? That's what he's saying. And I was with you in weakness and fear, much trembling. My speech, my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith, and here's the key, verse 5, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Now, that's what Jeremiah was talking about in Jeremiah 17, and that's what Paul speaks of here. I think this is what we're trying to get at. Who do we really trust? In Matthew 23, Jesus says, as he spoke against the scribes and the Pharisees, calling them hypocrites a number of times throughout the chapter, he says, whoever exalts himself, Matthew 23:12. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from people. You don't enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. In other words, they're standing at the door. They're trying to stop people from going. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, verse 15, because you travel around on sea and land to make one proselyte. And when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. You know, there's some things that Jesus says that I think today we would say, well, that's kind of mean, isn't it? That's a pretty harsh statement. Here these people are trying to make one proselyte. Well, they're not making a little bit of an effort. They're making this huge effort, crossing sea and land to make one proselyte. And Jesus says, when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. You're really hurting him. I mean, it's like what Jesus said earlier in Matthew when he says it is better for a man to hang a millstone around his neck and cast himself into the sea than to, you know, harm one of these little ones, the children. Look with me in Galatians 1. Galatians 1, we'll read verses 1 through 12, Paul writing to the Galatian churches. The area of Galatia is modern-day Turkey. It was days away, if not more than a week away from Jerusalem. And yet, I'm just trying to say this, it was far away from where Judah and Jerusalem were, but it had an extremely powerful Jewish influence. Paul writes some of his most scathing rebukes of Judaism to the letter here in Galatians. He writes the Galatian letter to the churches of Galatia. And this is the book where he says, I wish those who were circumcising would just cut themselves off. He's pretty clear about that in chapter 4. Here, chapter 1, Paul, an apostle, but notice he says, I'm an apostle not from men, nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father, who raised him from the dead and all the brothers who are with me. to the churches of Galatia. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from the present evil, according to the will of God the Father, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of God and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there's another one, but there are some who trouble you and they want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached, let him be accursed. This is an easy passage to use with Mormons. The Mormons teach that an angel by the name of Moroni actually gave Joseph Smith all the Book of Mormon, which contradicts the gospel. I go to Galatians 1, and it's like a dog with a bone. You just stay with it. They'll go on. You stay here. What about this? Even if an angel says anything that is different than what actually has already been delivered, then he should be accursed. So that's what verse 8, verse 9 says. As we've said before, now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Am I now seeking the approval of man or God? Am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I wouldn't be a slave of Christ. For I would have you know, brothers, the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. I didn't receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, Paul said. I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. I mean, he starts in verse 1, I'm an apostle, but not from men, but from Jesus. And I received all this, not from men, but from Jesus. Verse 1 and verse 12 kind of serve as bookmarks, if you will. His point is clear. What he has came from God, not from men. The point is, we show trust. Just like Jesus said in John 14, verse 15 and verse 23, 24. This is, in context, Jesus talking to the apostles. There's nobody else there. It's all except Judas Iscariot. He's left to go betray Jesus. We're told that in chapter 13, by the way. If you love me, Jesus told the apostles, you'll keep my commandments. I think that's interesting that he has to say this to them. It's not to the world. He doesn't say this to the world. This is a private conversation between himself and the apostles. And he tells them, if you love me, you're going to keep my commandments. If anyone loves me, which opens it up, anyone, he'll keep my word. And my Father will love him, will come to him, make our home with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words. And the word which you hear isn't mine. It's the Father's who sent me. I mean, even Jesus came as a messenger. I've always thought it so strange when people say, God told this to me. He put this on my heart. Jesus never comes up with something that is just so new. Jesus says, I'm here as a messenger, and I want you to say what I've said. Because if you love me, you're going to keep my commandments. You're going to do what I say. There are many other passages in John 15, John 16, where he keeps saying that. If you love me, if you're my friend, you'll do what I command. John 15, 14 is one passage. Paul will put it this way. The sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. Others, their sins follow after. Likewise, also, deeds that are good are quite evident, and those that are otherwise cannot be concealed. It's obvious, ultimately, what a person believes. That's my point. Do we really trust Jesus? Are we living a life that shows that or not? And I'm not saying every day is easy, because I don't think that. I really don't think that. There are going to be times in which it is harder, probably, to trust. There's one guy I read. He's an evangelical writer. His name is Philip Yancey. He's got some really good books. Where is God When I Hurt is a highly recommended book. Dealing with pain. It's kind of like the book of Job. He goes through a lot. And one of the things he talks about is trying to reach out to a God that doesn't talk back. He said it's like going into a room where there's a computer screen and you type in questions. And you get answers, but where are they coming from? And you don't know. Or you're told as you walk into a room, there's nobody in the other room. So ask anything you want. And that the Bible is there, but it's not like we have an easy concordance that just says, hey, look, you're having a tough day, turn to this passage. And we just read it and go, okay, well, that's easy. What to do when, you know, you bounce a check, you know, you go to this passage. No, there's nothing like that. There are principles by which we live. And I want to close with a few of these passages here in Matthew and then in James. Because what Jesus says in Matthew 7, 21 through 27 is, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, is acceptable. Notice with me, this is the closing section of the Sermon on the Mount. I know we don't always think of it in that way, but that's exactly what it is. Chapters 5, 6, 7 are the Sermon on the Mount in its entirety. It's the longest sermon we have from Jesus. In my mind, I think quickly to Acts, or rather Matthew 23 is the next longest, because that leads into 24, which is all part of that same sort of thing. But here in Matthew 7, 21, he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. We've probably all known people, if we've not been those people, who call out, you know, I'm a religious person, or, you know, we trust in Jesus. But it may be that the words don't follow the life, or the life don't follow the words. And that's what Jesus is saying. It's not people who say it, it's the people who do it. On that day, which I think in context we're talking about the judgment, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name? And we did many mighty works in your name. And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, workers of lawlessness. I'll be honest with you, this passage, if you stop here, is a little confusing because they're saying they're doing good things. And maybe that's the key, is just they're not doing them, actually. They're saying them. Because that's what he says. Verse 24, everyone then who hears these words and does them. And that's what he says. When you start the whole thing off in verse 21, just because you're saying it doesn't mean anything. The one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he's the one who's going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Just because you say you did all this doesn't mean you did all this. I didn't know you. Everyone then who hears these words and does them is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, winds blew, beat on that house, but it didn't fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears and does not do them. I mean, we've probably known people. I've been the hypocrite where I can quote Bible passages all over the place, but not always live them. So it's not just hypocrisy that Jesus is talking about. People who may sincerely say they believe these things, but they don't live that life sincerely at all. Again, they hear, but they don't do. He says, that's like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat that house. And it fell and great was its fall. Jesus makes it really simple. It's either this or that. You either hear and do, or you hear and you don't. Look over with me in James 1:21, a great passage. Because if we really love Jesus, if we really trust Jesus, we're going to do what he says. Doesn't mean it's always easy. James 1:21, be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. If anyone is a hearer of the word, not a doer, he's like a man who looks intently at the natural face in a mirror. He looks at himself and he goes away and immediately forgets what he was like. You and I don't really do this as much because we have mirrors everywhere. We see ourselves probably every single day. I'm pretty sure we do. In that time, most people didn't have access to a mirror every single day. You know, if you're wealthy, you might. Most people didn't. I don't even think most people thought about it. You can imagine the time in which we live with the selfies, you know. Okay, they would not be as much into that until you handed them the phone, right? Then they would be into it. But that's the point. You see yourself, but you don't take anything into account. You look at himself, verse 24, and he goes away and immediately forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres. It's the word patience, maybe. He really tries. Being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. And then let's pick it up in chapter 2:14. James says, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith? Isn't that what Jesus said? People are talking about they have faith, but they don't really have works. And that's what James asks. What if someone says he has faith, but he doesn't have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed, lacking daily food, and one of you just says to them, go in peace, be warm, be full, and you don't give them the things they need for their body, then what good is that? Well, I have good intentions, right? That's what Matthew 7:21, people who say, Lord, Lord, but they don't treat him like he's Lord, Lord. So James here is saying, in verse 16, one of you says all that, then what? It's no good. Also, faith by itself, if it doesn't have works, is dead. Someone will say, you have faith, I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. You believe God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see, faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. He was called a friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works, not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the harlot justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, even faith apart from works is dead. We've got all kinds of ways to illustrate this, but this is just the way James illustrates it. A body that doesn't have a spirit is dead. As the body apart from the spirit is dead. And the word spirit there means breath. That's literally what the word would be. Faith that is apart from works is dead. It's not any good. It's dead. We want to have that kind of faith that does more. I want to close with a passage here in Luke 7, 29, 30. We know Mark 16, 16. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. That's where in the Great Commission that Mark shares in Mark 16, 15, 16, he tells his apostles to go into all the world and preach the gospel. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who disbelieves will be condemned. I know there are people who argue, well, it doesn't say he who believes and is baptized and then say he who does not believe and is not baptized. I don't know why you would do that. How many of us would go buy a ticket to a game we're not planning to go to? You might do that as a gift. I get that. You might, you know, I like hockey. If someone gave me a ticket, I'd be really happy. Or if I bought a ticket for somebody, I'd intend for them to use it. But I would never buy a ticket and say, I have absolutely no intention of using the ticket. It's just dumb. It's a waste of money, and just kind of everybody around you is, that's just dumb. Let the Bible be its own commentary. If you ever talk to somebody who says Mark 16, verse 16 specifically, you know, doesn't make sense to them, then go to Luke 7, 29, 30. Because this is Mark 16, verse 16. When all the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledge God's justice having been baptized with the baptism of John. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. Now, we're talking a different time when Jesus had not commanded baptism in Luke 7, but it follows the same thing, exactly. The next verse, verse 30, says, but the Pharisees, we got a but there, so we understand by the but, there's a contrast. The Pharisees and lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves. How do you know? Not having been baptized by John. That's what the last part of Mark 16, 16 says. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. He who disbelieves will be condemned. There's no reason to emphasize anything more than that, but this fits. Let the Bible be its commentary, and that's what it goes to. Do we really trust? I know with a lot of people, that's the question I like to ask. Do you really trust Jesus? I know I've shared with you the story of this French guy. I can't remember. I was going to look him up, and I should have. You can look up on Google. It was in the 20th century that he crossed Niagara Falls on a tightrope. Set it up. It was a big to-do. People, you know, watched, clapped, thought it was cool, great, wonderful. And he asked the crowd if they thought he could do it with someone on his back. And they're like, yeah. You know how crowds are. They get worked up. And they're like, yeah, we want to see this. And he pointed to one person in the crowd, and the crowd fled. Who wants to actually get on someone's back and try to travel on a tightrope over Niagara Falls? So no one really believed he could do it. I mean, they could say and do it loudly, yeah, but then push come to shove, it doesn't happen. That's the kind of faith we're not supposed to have. We want the faith that says yes and then acts. And maybe I guess we could have just started with that and ended with it, right? Just said, yeah, that's the simplicity of it. Preachers don't do that. Faith without works is dead. Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commands. That's the simplicity. If we really trust Jesus, then we're going to do what he says, and we're going to do it with zeal. That's what Titus 2 would tell us about the grace of God that has come, bringing salvation to all men. The song we have is our invitation song number 59. It won't be very long. I know when we live life, we think it's got to come sooner than now. But the truth is, when it comes, whether it is our own passing or whether it is the Lord who comes, I know many of us are probably going to be thinking about a lot of missed opportunities and things because it's what we do. But we need to understand it won't be very long till this life is over and we stand before God in judgment. And we can be confident, not in ourselves, never in ourselves, but fully confident in the God of grace who has given us full access to Him through His Son Jesus. Hebrews 4 tells us that we have access to the throne of grace through Jesus. That's in Hebrews 4 and verses 12 and 13. And if we want, or 15, 16, excuse me, if we really want access, then it starts with us reaching out for Jesus Himself. Think of what we started with in Matthew 14, where Peter just says, look, if it's you, command me also. And when he commanded, he went out. And that's what we want. We want that kind of faith that acts. Come forward right now as we stand and sing.